Song Travels explores the journey singers and songs take together. This program is made possible by the National Endowment for the Arts and NPR.
Hello, I'm Michael Feinstein. My guest today is jazz and classical trumpeter and composer Wynton Marsalis. He comes from a musical family in New Orleans, and at 17 became the youngest musician admitted to Tanglewood's Berkshire Music Center. He's been awarded Grammys, a Pulitzer Prize, and the National Medal of Arts. His ability to blend jazz, gospel, big band, and classical genres is world-renowned. Wynton, welcome to Song Travels.
All right. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's a joy. It's a joy to share this program with you, because you have embodied so many types of music, and you have played so many songs. Would you say that melody is the most important factor in whatever you play?
Yeah, I think it's the face in the portrait. So a good friend of mine, Marcus Roberts, we were in a cab, we were in our early 20s, and we were talking about our music, and we were singing Thelonious Monk songs. And he said, man, you notice how our music doesn't have, like, a characteristic melody. So he said, let's sing some of our tunes. So we started to sing our songs, and we started laughing. And we said, we need to get more definitive melodies, and we need to concentrate on our melodic development. So down through the years, I find trying to learn other forms of music that the melodic imprint is many times the most difficult one to learn.
When you study other types of music, do you always find something familiar about it, as foreign as it might be?
I try to. In some traditions, the rhythm would be the most familiar. Generally, I try to learn the form first. So let's say if I'm trying to learn flamenco music, a form like Bulerias, where they're going, doom, digum, doom, digum, I try to figure out when is the cycle. So if they're going, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 1, 2, 3, 5. But I find that when I can hear the underlying structure, okay, I can keep my place in what they're playing, but now what do I do melodically? That's much more difficult. So it seems, for me, it's easier to learn the underlying structure. The melodies require a much more subtle understanding of the meanings of things. And I find that it's difficult to understand the meaning of something in another culture.
That's very interesting. How many times have you approached a song that you've played over and over and over again and discovered in the midst of performance something that confounds you and where you go with it? Does that happen all the time?
It happens to me a lot with the harmonies of the songs. At one point, I was trying to learn, just play melodies of songs. I did a recording with my father a long time ago, and I mainly played the melodies because my father used to always tell me, man, instead of making up all this stuff, why don't you just learn the melody to one tune?
Sounds like a dad.
You know, if you could just play one tune and learn the words and actually play the melody correctly, you would be doing much better. So I did a recording with him, and it was just only melodies. So I find that I was told that Ben Webster would recount the melody even when he was playing improvisations, and he would stop sometimes and say, I forgot the words.
Yeah, that's a famous story.
Yeah, you know, at different times I try different approaches. Like sometimes I only approach the harmony or the progressions of the songs. At other years, I would be trying to concentrate on how to play the melody. At different times, I concentrate on different things.
Well, speaking of working with your father, recording with your father, can we listen to a selection from that early collaboration?
Sure, we could. You know, the old man, you can't get better than him.
Here's an example of what we were talking about, of playing the melody. It's a song by Livingston and Evans called Never Let Me Go.
Right.
Thank you.
Never Let Me Go. I love that song. And there's a great story about Livingston Evans writing it, because Jay Livingston was known for writing things like Hey Sarah Sarah and Buttons and Bows, you know, kind of almost like sing-songy children's
cutesy, right.
And when he gave that song to Nelson Riddle to orchestrate for the first time for Nat Cole, Nelson Riddle looked at him and said, "You didn't write this." He didn't believe that Jay had that right. in him, and Jay was hurt, but then he realized that he had gone too commercial and it changed his life.
Right, right. Well, that song has so many ins and outs, too, like kind of chromatic motion. And it also, it's interesting because it changes moods.
It goes from sort of light and air. You start to see the sunshine, then you retreat, and then "You wouldn't hurt me, would you?"
Right.
"You wouldn't do it, could you? Never let me." Yeah.
It has like a real kind of skillful use of the kind of chromatic half steps. Do-dee-doo-dee-woo-doo-dee-doo-dee-doo-dee. The half step is an interesting interval because it's a melodic, non-melodic. Mm. It's like the closest thing and it's the furthest away. Mm. I always look at the half step as being like a man and a woman. It's the two things that are the closest that are the furthest away. And the skillful use of a half step. So, some songs like Lush Life or really mature songs, I find that they always have an interesting half step relationship. And also Thelonious Monk, a lot of his music has that doo-dee, doo-doo-doo-dee. It's always like a syncopated motion of a half step. Uh-huh. Then you have the writers like Hoagy Carmichael that were kids hearing Louis Armstrong play. And Louis Armstrong was a young person himself. Mm. And you have a great song like Stardust, which has a kind of revelry, kind of fantasia type of feeling with the same thing with these half steps that we were talking about. Mm-hmm. And here's Louis Armstrong doing a version of a definitive version of of this song written by Hoagy Carmichael that Hoagy listens to and says, "Wow, I wish I would have written it the way he sang it." But Hoagy was listening to Lewis when he was a teenager.
So it was full circle in a certain way.
It was all everybody, and they all knew each other.
Yes.
Sometimes when we talk about songs and things as dry historical fact, we don't deal with the fact that all of these musicians and craftsmen, they knew each other. And they had personal relationships that were intense about music. Mm-hmm. And they were dealing with trying to elevate kind of the feeling and the consciousness of our country. It was very much on their mind. They wanted people to feel a certain way. And we're lucky to have this great recorded legacy.
Do you miss that today?
Yeah, I do.
Me too.
I miss it.
It's hard for people to understand the impact that music had on previous generations because it has become, in an odd way, marginalized in spite of the fact that technology has given us greater access to it than ever.
Right. Everything is a transition, and I think that we'll see in the rebound from this added amount of music, you'll see the next generations will start to adjust and say, "Wait a second, we had this, let's add this back." Mm-hmm. And that's why I feel that all of the work that we do is important, and that we don't get discouraged, and that we continue to have even more intensity about coming together and creating new things that actually have the substance of the older things. So that the next group will see, "Hey, look at what they came together and they did this and this is what they talked about." Because it's one thing you see you and I on a radio show, but we know each other. So it's not, we're talking. Right. You might see us on a show and you might think, "Well, Michael Feinstein is this way and Wynton Marsalis is that way." But we're just two people who love music that want to play. There's so many other elements of that story. And I think that when I think of Hoagy Carmichael and Louis Armstrong, mm-hmm. There's so many things we don't know.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because the other day in speaking to Andre Previn, Hoagy's name came up, and he said that Hoagy was not a nice guy. Mm-hmm. He said that he was difficult, and he was anti-Semitic, and he said that he was racist. And I said, "Well, how could he be racist because he was so close to Louis Armstrong?" He said, "Well, he was selectively racist." Uh-huh. And Hoagy's music is something that has inspired me greatly, and now when I listen to that, I think about that. It bothers me.
It doesn't. What a person is or was or how they were, unless they were like a mass murderer or something and they acted on what they said, it does not bother me at all. Mm. There are points in time, there are things people say. Sometimes you say something, you don't even believe it. And sometimes
look at politics.
You know, sometimes you can lie to yourself for so long you believe it. Sometimes it's a glorious thing you think about yourself that's not true. Yeah. I tend to deal with, when I'm talking about work and people, I don't really, their work speaks for them across time, not what they said in a bar or whether they were
I guess it doesn't matter that Brahms was an SOB and was horrible to Tchaikovsky, because Brahms is still great.
You know, I deal with him for what I like. Yeah. Like, I don't care who was a drug addict. I don't care what affairs people had. I don't care everybody's life is fraught with difficulties. Mm-hmm. And we all negotiate our way through our lives the best we can, or the best we know how, with what we have. Sometimes we rise above what we are, and sometimes we fall below it. Mm. But those who create works that can resonate across time so that it can influence you or I, we want to get the nourishment from it. Mm-hmm. The kind of salacious facts about people's lives and all that. I'm busy trying to work on them for my own life.
Yeah, me too.
I don't want to figure out how to.
Right.
And, you know, so that a guy said some anti-Semitic things, or that he was racist, said something against some black people in a time when that was a common thing that people said in private. I'm sure there's not a lot of public commentary on that.
Right.
And you were privy to it, so be it. It's still, Stardust is still a great song.
Yeah.
You don't have to be an angel for me to accept what you did.
Mm-hmm. So let's play what we're talking about. Let's listen to what I think is the first vocal recording of the song Stardust, sung by Bing Crosby. This is from 1931.
And now the purple dusk of twilight time steals across the meadows of my heart. High up in the sky the little stars climb, always reminding me that we're apart. You wander down the lane and far away, leaving me a song that will not die. Love is now the stardust of yesterday, the music of the years gone by.
That was an early Crosby recording of Stardust. Now let's listen to Pops.
Sometimes I wonder why I spend a lonely night, baby, dreaming of a song melody, my memory, and I once again with you, when the love was new, oh baby, each kiss an inspiration, baby, baby, that was long ago, now my consolation. It's in the stardust of a song, beside a garden wall. When stars are bright, you are in my arms, baby, baby. The nightingale still is very ill. Our paradise where roses bloom. Though I dream in vain, oh baby, in my heart, it will remain. My stardust melody, the memory of love refrain, mama, love refrain.
That was Louis Armstrong's vintage and iconic recording of Stardust, preceded by Crosby's vocal performance of it. What an amazing contrast between those two performances from the same approximate era.
It's important for us to understand many times the history of our music. We say in the 30s they did this, or in the 40s. These are two people who knew each other. And now they knew each other when they were 29, 30, 33, 34. Now they're 56, 55, 59. And they are now icons of American music. But their relationship is still personal, and it still goes back 30-something years. And all of those 30 years is in what they play.
Yeah, you hear it and you feel it.
Right.
The final year of Armstrong's life is something that you know a lot about, because recently you were one of the first people privy to a recording that is his last documented performance. Would you talk about that?
Well, this performance is for a homeboy. Vernon Louvier, and it was a party. And people are talking, and Pops is doing his thing, and he's playing all what he normally plays. He plays Sleepy Time Down South, and he is. You can tell he's not in the. You can tell he's in bad health, but his sound just always has a vibrance and a life. It's something spiritual that's in it, and with all the great musicians and performers, they have a charisma in their sound, and nobody knows where it comes from. And I once asked Miles Davis about his sound. He said, "Man, how'd you develop your sound like that?" "That's just my sound." What can you tell somebody? That's his sound. It's not like you said, "I'm going to make my sound have this charisma in it." It's just they play, and whatever that is that's in them comes out. And in that final documented performance, you hear Pops. He's what he is.
Let's hear a bit of that recording of When It's Sleepy Time Down South.
Cause I know when it's sleepy time down south, it's south wind blowing through the pinewood trees. The folks down there live a life of ease. When old mammy falls on her knees, when it's sleepy time down is steamboats up the river coming to go in, dabby dabby up apples splashing the night away, bamboo do 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 hear those banjos ringing. And our folks are singing, and they dance, oh yes, in the break of day, yes. Dear old Southland, with this dreamy song, you take me back where I belong, right in. Good evening, everybody.
That was Sleepy Time Down South, Louis Armstrong, written by, among others, Clarence Muse, who's a very interesting character. I just found a record of him from the 30s. A fascinating guy who was an actor, sort of a jack of all trades, and was even in the film Porgy and Bess in the late 50s. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these people are so ephemeral, but their achievements are so extraordinary.
Right, and all intertwined. That's why I wish I knew the history. Like, so when I'm talking with you and you say that was this and that was, you know, just when you have that grasp of the history of these songs, that in itself is a lesson. Because everybody is doing, people are doing a lot of different things together, and the life of all of that is in these songs that we love.
Yes, and these songs are such a document of society at the time that they were created.
Right.
And one of the things that I was thinking about the other day is how Harry Warren, who had so many big hits with You'll Never Know, Lullaby of Broadway, and The Atchison, Topeka, when he was a staff writer at one of his publishing companies, he was writing with all different kinds of people, black and white. And the music business was integrated. Right. And it's so interesting to me that the expression of what went out to people, they just loved the music and they didn't know where it came from. And there was a collaboration which was very much ahead of its time that existed in the music business, even though there were the sharks out there and there were people taking advantage. But there also was something that allowed collaborative spirit right. that was unique, I think.
Well, that's because of the internal nature of music. Everything on the outside, showbiz presentation had to be cosmetic and fake mm-hmm. because it was to go along with, it's still that way.
It's only a paper moon.
It was, to, you know, yes, yeah, to go along with, or Careless Love, W.C. Handy, Silkless Silk, Milkless Milk. Like we get used to, we used to something that's not the thing, but the thing itself is what resonates. So when you get internal with human beings, you fall in love. Is somebody not going to fall in love because they're a black person? Is somebody not, somebody have less imagination or somebody has less or more? No, we're people. We have the same basic. We get hungry. We want to go to the bathroom. We fall in love. We want our kids to do well. We want to be happy. We want people to make us feel good about being ourselves. Mm. And the music industry was a way, especially with the radio, which the airwaves, you didn't know who you were listening to a lot of times, whether a band was black, whether it was white. You just listen to it. You could be a white kid in Omaha or somewhere, and you'd be, wow, I love this band.
Well, Johnny Mercer was very proud of the fact that he got a letter from some kids in Chicago that said that he was their favorite colored singer.
Well, you know what I mean? Nobody knew. So, and that allowed for an equality, and it allowed for an assessment of things on their own human terms. Yeah. And with writing music, it's the same way. Like, all the kind of hits of the big band era, so many of them by white bands were penned by Afro-American mm-hmm. writers. What difference did it make? It was the same instrumentation, the same mm-hmm. forms, the same. Mark O'Connor and I always laugh about that. When we get together, we could sit down and we rehearse for an hour. We don't need a page of music. We just start playing. This is yeah. our music. It's our heritage. Mm-hmm. You know, we play Sweet Georgia Brown, Kareen, all these songs, they're American songs, mm-hmm. hymns and all the things that are part of our, we're not saying, man, that's a great black hymn, or that's a great, even at this point, you play Negro spirituals, it's music that we know. We grew up hearing it. Mm-hmm. And the national heritage is a certain way. It is integrated.
Right.
And that's the nature of it. It's how we teach it and how we understand it. And it was accepted without fanfare.
Good point. What is it about the blues that keeps reinventing itself over and over again, and the reach that it's had with contemporary music, with rock and roll, with all the British invasion? What is it about that, I guess, deceptively simple form of notes?
Right.
It's like a magic.
Right. It's fundamental. That's what it is. It's like the grand unification theory that Einstein was looking for, that one thing at which all things intersect. All the laws and all the things are answered by an equation. Let's look at what it is. It's a 12-bar form. It's like 12 months of the year, signs of the zodiac. Okay, it is has three sections, a three-act play, beginning, middle, end, all the different threes we have, three, the Father, Son, the Holy Spirit, we're going on with the three. It's a pentatonic scale, do 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 dee 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 da of Eastern music, do 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 dee 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 dee.
I got rhythm.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Right. It's the major and minor together. So instead of do do dee 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 do do dee 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 do 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 dee do dee 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 do 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 dee dee do do. So you can hear that major sound, the kind of uplift, and then you can hear that ooh. You put it together. It is the 1-4 and 5 chord, the three basic harmonies of Western music, Bach chorales, everything that deals with the tempered scale, 1-4-5, the first thing that you mm-hmm. learn. And we could go deep into call and response. It's more room for response than for call. It's like mm-hmm. life itself. Mm-hmm. Like something happens and you respond to it. So the blues is, well, the 219 took my baby away. Do 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 dee 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 dee. Well, the 219 took my baby away.
The response is essential because otherwise
right. It's just open space.
Yeah.
And it's also, it tells you two things and then it answers itself. I went down to the station to put my head on the railroad tracks.
Right.
Oh, something bad is going to happen.
Right.
I went down to the station where when the train come along, I snatched my fool head back. It almost always ends optimistically. Like I was thinking about this, life is a drag. My baby left me. But I'm still here.
Right.
Then it has the shuffle rhythm of African music. Ting, 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 ting. The kind of 6 against 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. the Washington Post March, the 6/8 of Irish jigs, mm-hmm. all troubadour music, English dances, because the English are the one who taught us how to dance men and women. Didn't come from Africa. Mm. Unless we start to look at what's in the blues and we say, man, everything is in here. Mm-hmm. Then deeper than the blues, if you get like a recording of No, the Japanese music, No, it's,
right.
it's just like bent cracks of notes.
Yeah. Yeah,
and
yeah.
things with space in the middle of between, in between sounds. And you get a flamenco singer from the early era singing a saita or something. And then you put on blues yeah. singer like Son House singing Who's That Riding, John the Revelator? And you play them back to back. It's like the same music.
Who is Son House?
Son House is a great blues man, of the father of the Delta blues. Robert Johnson and all of them come out of him, Muddy Waters. They come out of Son House, the great Son House. We got to play some Son House.
Oh,
there.
My gosh. Well, let's.
Yeah, another good one is Pearlene with him playing.
Shall we listen to that?
Pearlene, yeah. That's the blues.
Okay, Pearlene it is.
Oh, you're going to love him. Yeah, he's for real.
Pearlene. Pearlene. Yeah.
Son House, not Sun Ra, Son House.
Yeah, Son House, for real.
That is seminal.
Yes.
Well, there's more coming up in a moment with Wynton Marsalis. Our program is made possible in part by NPR and the National Endowment for the Arts, Art Works. I'm Michael Feinstein, and this is Song Travels from NPR Music. Well, you took the blues and wrote a Pulitzer Prize-winning piece, Blood in the Fields, based on the blues.
Right.
That is a mighty accomplishment. That piece is something that I've listened to many times, and I find it so extraordinarily personal in how it affects my soul. How did you embark on writing large-scale works? Was there ever a moment of can I do this or doubt? Because to get to that point is something that is a very long journey.
You know, I think even when I was in high school, I was in a theory class, and I went to arts high school. And for some reason, I would always know what the form of pieces were.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't as good with knowing the specific harmonies, but I could play a Beethoven symphony. I just knew, okay, the form mm-hmm. is this, and it's its themes. And I always felt I had a skill just for detecting the movement of themes through a form. I never thought about writing jazz, long-form pieces, or even being a composer. I came to it late. Like, I was writing for my first album, and Herbie Hancock said, you have to write your tunes. I'm not writing them. Then I was 19. I started writing songs. I never considered myself a composer. Then as time went on, I got more and more into it. I always loved, like, the great composers. Beethoven was always my favorite. Of course, Bach, from playing a lot of the music, Haydn, playing classical music, I got to hear these great pieces. In my younger years, I was not as familiar with the work of Duke Ellington, so I didn't know that jazz, too, had created a composer of the same magnitude of insight into the nature of form from an American perspective. Mm-hmm. By the time I was in my early 20s, I had realized, because I was listening to Duke Ellington, I thought, man, I didn't understand Duke Ellington did so, these things.
So you knew you knew the pop songs of Ellington, but not that he wrote the larger scale, or
you
didn't?
Yeah, I knew he wrote Sophisticated Lady and In a Sentimental Mood. I'd heard the record with him and John Coltrane. Hmm. I wasn't really aware of who Duke Ellington was, his magnitude. My father once asked me if I wanted to hear Duke Ellington. This was in like 1971 or 70 when he was playing at New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival. I just thought it's like some old big band music. I stayed home and watched the Oakland Raiders football game.
Oh, man.
So whenever I'm asked, did I see Duke, the one chance I had to see him, no. And I wasn't into jazz so much at that time. I was like a typical person in my neighborhood. We didn't listen to jazz. We was pop music. Mm. You know, James. They asked me if I saw James Brown. Yeah, Paul Funkadelic, yes. So later, I came into contact with someone like Albert Murray, who knew Duke and was like a big kind of my mentor, so of course I became grounded in Duke. And my father loved Duke. He had Duke records, but I didn't listen to those recordings with him. I was listening to Jelly Roll Martin, Library of Congress recordings.
Yes.
Then I was 20, 21, and Jelly Roll started to talk about form. And some kind of way he talked about sectional form. And I noticed with his pieces that he was able to hook the sections together. Like he'd start one section, he'd come up with a little transitional material, and mm-hmm. I took his way of doing long-form pieces and started trying to learn my own way. But I didn't start to write those kind of things until I was, I think, in my late 20s, maybe. And I felt, yeah, I could deal with the long forms, because I think one of my strengths as a musician is the ability to hear across time. Like, I would always notice if I listen to a long piece, like a symphony by a Mahler symphony or a Brahms symphony, I would be with some friends who had listened to the symphony, and we would start to discuss it. I could remember the thematic development, and they would say, man, you remember, let's go get the score. And, yeah, it was there. That was kind of the inverse of this theme, or that's what he did with the orchestration. I don't know why.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt that when I applied that same skill to writing long form pieces, I would have a natural feeling for it.
Oh, boy, you did. Do you feel that in the world today, different genres of music are becoming closer together, like classical and jazz and pop? Everything is categorized, but there are certain artists today who are combining and blending elements, and certainly you have done that through your career because of your background and because of your sensibility and understanding of the oneness of our planet.
Yeah, I think so. I think we're coming together. The stage has been set for us by many musicians we had. Even you go all the way back to Bach, mm-hmm. some Italian concertos, they found he wrote it. Or
mm-hmm.
Richard Wagner, reaching back to Greek mythology and mm-hmm. wanting to write things with a Japanese story, and on and on and on. You know, mm-hmm. we can go through the history of the arts, and we see that. And with our music, certainly with the American popular song, so many multiplicity of influences.
You have collaborated with so many different artists. It's a dizzying list of people, from Willie Nelson to Eric Clapton to Shirley Horn to Andre Previn, Kathleen Battle, Bobby McFerrin, Diane Reeves. The list goes on and on. Can we listen to a couple of performances of some of your favorite collaborations?
Sure, man, sure.
Bobby McFerrin. Bobby McFerrin is, I think, singular in this planet.
Right. I agree with that. I first met Bobby when I was in high school, and he was in New Orleans. It's a place called Tyler's Beer Gardens. He used to be in there, and I started playing there. I was in the first jazz band that ever played there. I think I was 14. It was the first gig I ever played of jazz. Some guys, college guys, a guy named Alvin Young, played bass, called me for a gig because he knew my father, and he said, yeah, Ellis's son plays trumpet. And I had never really played a gig, so it was all like kind of older college age or older guys playing, and I was the trumpet player. So I knew Bobby then, and he is singular. Just the amount of music he knows, his dedication to music. Another one, Daddy's a musician. And yeah, Bobby is like practicing constantly, learning a lot of music, very enthusiastic, always about turning people onto the joys of music, defies categorization, is interested in a lot of things, and has an impeccable technique that he's worked on for years and years and years.
What can we play by you and Bobby?
Bobby did a piece on the studio with me called Baby, I Love You, which is like a throwaway piece. We just did it for fun. It's on our record called The Magic Hour.
Let's listen.
Hey, Bobby. Thank you.
baby, I love you. Oh, baby, I love you. In the morning when the sun comes by, in the moonlight, oh, my honey pie, I'm thinking, oh, baby, I love you. Oh, baby, baby, I love you. Baby, baby, I love you. Baby, I love you. When I'm working on my 9 to 5, I get the work done 'cause you on my mind. Oh, baby, 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 I love you.
Our guest Wynton Marsalis with Bobby McFerrin. Two free spirits.
We just play it around.
Oh, my. Shirley Horn. Shirley Horn is a lady who has inspired me greatly. When I collaborated with Johnny Mandel, he spoke of his desire to work with her and subsequently created an album that is considered one of the finest of any era, Here's to Life, and you are beautifully on that in collaboration with her.
Yeah, I loved her, just talking with her and being in her presence. And she was smooth. You know, she had to have her drambuie, and she was okay. And her phrasing was unbelievable, just where she played in the time. And her playing was so beautiful, the way she accompanied herself. She called the slowest tempos. Boy, you'd be thinking, it can't be at this tempo, but there it was. And she really loved me. Like she and I had a very close, a certain type of closeness. And she really wanted me to do great things for the music. She was very supportive. And whenever I would call her, ask her to do something, she would always...
She was there.
Yeah, she was always. Mm-hmm. I miss her.
I had the pleasure of meeting her on a couple of occasions, and it's one of those situations where I was almost tongue-tied because of the enormity of how I felt about her talent.
Mm. Yeah, she was a presence about all about music.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Like she come out very wispy, then when the music starts, just the first note is a mood immediately.
Mm.
You know, surely it's that mood take over the room.
Let's listen to A Time for Love from her Here's to Life album.
A time for summer skies, and butterflies. For tender words that harmonize with love. A time for climbing hills, for leaning out of windowsills, admiring the daffodils above. A time for holding hands together. Time for rainbow-colored weather. A kind of make-believe that we've been dreaming of. Whatever sky above, I've known a time for spring, a time for fall, but best of all, a time. Holding hands together, a time for rainbow colored weather, a kind of make believe that we've been. I've known a time for spring. A time for fall, but best of all, a time for
marvelous performance. It's such a great melding of so many different traditions, really, because Johnny Mandel came from a big band jazz background and ended up writing these very lush settings, and it gave Shirley this marshmallow cushion to present her like a shining diamond, and then there you are,
right,
raising your voice with her. Beautiful, beautiful.
I just was appreciative of the opportunity to record with her.
Well, it's lovely. It's lovely. It's one of my favorites. I would like to talk about something that you've created that has affected many lives, the wonderful program at Jazz at Lincoln Center, of which I'm privileged to be a part. And I know that your life is dedicated to, most of all, education, passing it on, teaching the kids, making it available to souls that might not otherwise have the opportunity. And you've done something extraordinary there. And I marvel at how you've done it and how it continues and thrives because of the singular nature of the whole venture.
Mm-hmm. We have four basic objectives: a curatorial, we put on concerts. Our goal is to consolidate a lot of the history and tradition of jazz and get new arrangements and new music, but also the thing that we're involved in is to consolidate aspects of American root music and bring the musics together. And that's kind of a long-term project that we may not see it, but we just get it off the ground and work. And then 25, 30 years from now, we see some other people saying, yeah, you know, they tried to do this. Now let's do this. How can we bring the folk music and the bluegrass and the country music and the American popular song and the blues, and how do we bring all these things together? How do we get our musics? Because first, they're already together. People have already played. Louis Armstrong played with Jimmy Rogers.
Mm-hmm.
Billie Holiday sang the American song. Rosemary Clooney. We have the history of our tradition is already people.
Already mongrel.
It's already done that. And that was their objective.
Yes.
Was to do these things. There's an informality to our way and a naturalness to the way that we relate to each other, and a democratic way where you have your space, but you have to recognize. I was listening to the radio and Frank Sinatra's daughter was talking about how he was with musicians and how he loved them and how
more than anything.
Yeah, he knew that, hey, I'm not going to play unless Sweet Edison is here. You got to take care of this. You don't know who this musician is and how much the music was so much about a joint working. It's so much about us coming together.
Mm-hmm.
We are about bringing that to as many people as we can bring it to.
Does it ever seem like a struggle in the light of so much of the world changing so quickly? Or is it always with hope and looking at the bigger picture? I mean, does it ever become daunting?
You know, it's always a struggle, but that's the hope. The struggle is the hope. If there's no hope, there's no struggle. So when you embrace the struggle, you've embraced the hope. It's like somebody said, I don't want to practice. Well, okay. That's one of my father's great teaching. Okay, don't practice. I don't want to exercise. Okay, don't exercise. Well, I don't want to change the world. Okay, don't change the world.
Mm-hmm.
But as always, don't feel like you're going to turn a tide or create a kind of a feeling in the world that you want to create, and without recruiting other people and getting with them and figuring out what you all have in common and purifying your intentions and accepting the fact that you're another person out here.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's not just waiting for you to, oh, he's here. Let's adjust everything we've been doing to make sure he's cool. You didn't embrace the challenge. So I used to always love to tell my two oldest kids a story about the Knights of the Round Table, where Sir Lancelot comes to a bridge that's a blade of a sword, and it's over a moat. And he has to get across that bridge to get to the queen, who's in a castle being held prisoner. And every knight fell into the moat because they kept their armor on and they were trying to keep their balance. And he took his armor off and crawled across, and he made it. And when he was coming back, they asked him, why did you take your arm off? And he said, I didn't want to have to worry about getting cut. Because he looked at it and he assessed, this bridge is about getting cut. So if you embrace that you will be cut, there's a remote possibility that you can make it across. If you don't embrace that, you'll never make it.
That's a beautiful analogy. Well, I think it's appropriate, if you agree, to end this with something by Duke Ellington.
Oh, yeah.
Because in many ways it all begins and ends with him.
You know, I always loved Duke Ellington's second line from the New Orleans Suite. And that's the suite that he was writing in the same year that my daddy told me, come check out Duke, and I didn't check him out. This is a true story. It combines the feeling of New Orleans music. You have the clarinet and the trombones playing with the big band, something people have been trying to do for all of the 20th century, and no one succeeded. And Duke figured out how to turn it into an unbelievably swinging chart. And it's after Billy Strayhorn has passed away. Everybody's saying, what is Duke going to do? Yeah. He gives us this masterpiece, the New Orleans Suite. And the second line is the group of dancers that follow the parade down the street. Mm. And Duke really captures that. He also has a trumpet solo in it that signifies Louis Armstrong. Duke, of course, loved Louis Armstrong above all else, besides Sidney Bechet, who was another great New Orleans musician that played with Duke for a brief time in the 20s.
And is this after Louis's passing?
This is around the time of Louis Armstrong's passing. I think he wrote it before Louis Armstrong. He wrote this before Louis Armstrong passed away. I'm sure of that.
Well, let's listen to a portion of this recording. Second line from the New Orleans Suite.
Yeah.
Marvelous way to wind up this program. Wynton Marsalis, thank you so much for sharing your your talent, your humanity, and your vision for a better life.
Thank you. You know, it's a pleasure. Always the deepest respect and love for you.
I love you too, man.
We out here. We doing our things. Thank you.
All blessings.
Yes, sir.
You've been listening to Song Travels with host Michael Feinstein and his guest Wynton Marsalis. Song Travels is a production of South Carolina ETV Radio and is recorded at Hirsch Studios in New York, with post-production in the Elaine T. Freeman Suite at ETV Radio in Columbia, South Carolina. The producer is Sherry Hutchinson, recording engineer Duke Marcos, assistant recording engineer Andrew Shire, mastering engineer David Mitchell, production manager Grant Jackson. The executive producer is Kobe Hennessy. The executive in charge is Linda O'Brien. We love to hear from you. Our email address is songtravels@scetv.org. Our postal address is ETV Radio, 1041 George Rogers Boulevard, Columbia, South Carolina, 29201. You can find out more about the artists and music on this series by visiting our website, scetv.org/songtravels. Support for Song Travels comes from NPR and the National Endowment for the Arts, ArtWorks. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and NPR contributors, which include the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children both in and out of school, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.